Good afternoon, everybody. This is Tira Warner with the Raw Divas, and I have on the phone with me Dr. Rita Marie Lascauzo, and she is, we've been calling her the glutenator. She's here to do some gluten busting with us, and Dr. Rita Marie, I really want to thank you for being with us here today, and we're very excited about what you have to share.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here, and it's very exciting for me to be able to talk about this topic.
One of the things I thought we would do to start, and I know we have a list of things we're going to cover, but I thought we could just sort of start easy from point one. So suppose I'm someone who, like a lot of standard North Americans, get up in the morning and I have my toast for breakfast and a sandwich for lunch, and, you know, spaghetti or pasta or something like that for supper.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you start with someone like me in giving us a little bit of an overview of what's going on with gluten?
Okay, well, I would love to start with what is gluten, because people are a little bit confused. You know, you hear the term and you go, well, it's something I'm not supposed to do, but what really is it? Is that okay if I start there?
Yeah, that's perfect.
Okay, well, gluten is actually a protein. And a protein is a string of amino acids, and our body can't use the protein, but it uses the amino acids. So a gluten is a protein that's found in wheat, rye, barley, questionable about oats, spelt, and kamut. So it's in grains, not all grains, because there are non-gluten grains, but it is a protein in grains. And it has been, it's a very gluey substance, which I guess is where the gluten came from, the name gluten came from. It basically, when you eat things that contain gluten, it causes kind of a glue-like mass to form in your intestinal tract. So that's one of our good reasons to stop eating it. But really, let me step that back a second. When we eat the gluten in these grains, it can cause health problems. And the health problems have been known about for many, 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 many years. And as far back as the 1930s, I found studies that indicated that it's not just problems in your intestines, but it can cause problems in your skin, problems in your nervous system, problems with depression, behavior, et cetera, et cetera. So I'll get into that in a little bit more detail, but I wanted to give you a little bit of overview of what gluten is and where it's found. Okay? So does that answer your question?
Yeah, that's a good start with what is gluten. Yes, for sure.
Yeah, okay. So I don't want to get too detailed and too technical, and I can get more detailed and more technical. So, Tira, I'm going to have you be the gauge as to where that goes.
That's perfect. I think we've got a great start, so let's keep rolling with it.
Okay. Okay, so what would you like me to address next?
Oh, okay. Well, why don't you sort of explain, I mean, why is gluten a problem for people?
That's a great thing. Okay, so gluten is a problem in that there's several things that are associated with problems with gluten. One is a lot of people are sensitive to it, meaning they either have an allergy, a true allergy, which is an immune system reaction, or a sensitivity to it. Gluten, immune system reactions to gluten are very, very widespread, much more common than people think. And there's this protein in gluten, and then it's broken down into these strings, and the most problematic one is called gliadin, which unfortunately is found in everybody's favorite food, which is wheat, which is the bread, the toast, the pasta, all those wonderful things that you just described that really does describe the standard North American diet. So gluten is a problem if you've got a sensitivity to it, in that it causes the immune system, which is our body's protective, you know, our force out there, our army going out there and protecting us from invaders. Well, it perceives the gluten as an invader, and it mounts this incredible attack so that it can take that protein that's in the gluten and just, you know, demolish it as if it was a bacteria, excuse me, or a microbe that's going to harm you. In the process of doing that, it creates inflammation. And the inflammation is what causes all the problems that, or, you know, part of the problems in the immune system part that gluten is known for. So it causes inflammation, and it causes a lot of inflammation. First of all, it can cause inflammation in your intestinal tract. and a disease that's called celiac. Are you familiar with that, celiac disease?
Yes. We've heard that name, but maybe you want to just explain it briefly for anybody who might not be familiar with it.
Well, a condition known as a medical condition that you'll find in all the medical pathology books is called celiac disease. And celiac disease is a sensitivity to gluten that results in damage to what's called the cilia in the small intestine. And the cilia are these little, like, finger-like projections in the small intestine that are what facilitate our absorption. And when those things get damaged, it actually causes a flattening. So if you can imagine your small intestine as this tube, and the tube has these finger-like projections, almost like the little hairs in your nose, like the little, you know, protective hairs in your nose. It's like these finger-like projections. And they allow the foods that are fully digested to pass between them. Well, what happens in celiac disease is those things get completely flattened. So imagine like one of those, you know, kind of truck things that go down the road and flatten things out. I forget what they're called, but it just imagine that going through your intestine and flattening out all the cilia. It wreaks havoc in your intestinal tract. It causes symptoms like gas and bloating and diarrhea and, oops, I just ate, now I have to go to the bathroom feeling, which a fair number of people experience. It's estimated, and this is in the medical literature, that about 3% of the population have full-blown celiac disease. Now, there's variations on that. If you've got a gluten intolerance, it can be creating some damage in the cilia, in the small intestine, but it's also creating inflammation that can damage various parts throughout the body. And a little bit of knowledge about how the immune system works really helps in understanding how this gluten problem affects you.
Okay.
There's these proteins, right? Like a bacteria is made of protein. A food, there's protein in it. And the proteins have these little amino acids that are on, you know, this throughout. What the body, the immune system does is it creates these antibodies that attack it on either end. And it's kind of like a lock and a key. You know how if you have a key, you have a whole set of keys, but you can only get one of the keys to go in a particular door? You can try them. They don't look exactly alike. They won't go in that door and open it, right? So with the immune system, it creates these little antibodies that are very specific for a specific protein. Unfortunately, they're not as specific as our keys. Because what they're doing, if there's a similarity between, say, the gluten protein that this antibody is attacking and some of the proteins in your thyroid gland, then what happens is the antibody that gets created to attack the gluten then attacks your thyroid gland. Causes the thyroid to get all swollen and inflamed. It can't produce thyroid hormones, which affects your metabolism, which causes all the symptoms of hypothyroid, which we can go on into in another call if you want to. So does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
So that's what's happening in your body when you're eating gluten, when you're sensitive to it. It creates this army, so to speak, in your immune system that goes out and attacks it and gets rid of it. But in the process of attacking it and getting rid of it, it's creating inflammation. It can create problems in your digestion, and then it can create inflammation in various parts of your body that cause malfunction. So I mentioned the thyroid, but you can also have that happening in the brain. They've been found a cross-reactivity between gluten antibodies and some of the cells like the cerebellum, which is our balance center in the brain, and some of the cells in what's called the hippocampus, which is where our short-term memory and some of our regulation systems occur. So it's really a widespread problem.
Hmm. Okay.
So go ahead.
Yeah. Now, inflammation, I don't want to be too, you know, when I think of the evils of gluten, inflammation, what's so bad about inflammation? Like, I know that question might be a little bit
okay,
simple,
that's a great question.
Yeah.
Okay, inflammation is actually a natural body defense mechanism. If you cut open your arm and you've got this whole immune system reaction that comes in to try to heal that area, and inflammation is part of that to bring extra blood and extra fluids into the area. And that's fine if you have an arm and it that's hurt and it's short term and it needs to be repaired and it gets repaired and we're done, right? But what happens with the inflammation that is in other parts of the body it actually, the inflammatory chemicals in the blood, the extra blood and liquid, actually expand that area. So, for example, say you bang a joint in your finger and it's inflamed. Well, that finger is usually only, about a half an inch wide? And suddenly you're fitting all this extra fluid into that area. You're going to get pain. So inflammation is always associated with some sort of pain. Let me just step back a second. It's not always associated with some sort of pain, but it's usually associated with pain. In the case of when gluten or some other allergen is attacking parts of your brain or your thyroid, you may not get pain, but the inflammation is actually interfering with the normal function of that area. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay. So thanks for clarifying that, just because it helps. I know sometimes inflammation, I just wanted us to feel more the pain of,
yeah.
of what having inflammation means.
Right.
One of the things I'd really like you to address is the fact that, you know, if I sit down or if anyone sits down to a plate of steamed broccoli, at a certain point we can stop, you know. But something like a plate of noodles, it's almost as though we're eating and we have this feeling like you could just keep eating it and eating it, and it's really hard to stop eating that kind of food. Can you address a little bit the addictive nature of these foods, or if there is?
Because that was, I was there. I mean, I just have these memories of taking big pieces of Wonder Bread and rolling the bread piece up in balls and just eating the little balls. You can eat a whole loaf of bread pretty quickly that way. You know, or sitting down to the noodles and going, I can't get enough. Absolutely, it's very addictive. And the reason that it's addictive, this has been, I'm not sure exactly when this research was done, but it's been known for a long time. It just hasn't really gotten that popularized, is that when you take a long protein and you break it down, what the body needs to use is amino acids, these little teeny like balls. If you can envision, like if you've ever had kids or played with kids, and you have those long, those things that they're plastic and they pop together, they have little things at the end and you pop them together and you can make these long strings. You ever seen those? Did your kids ever play with those?
Yeah.
Well, if you think about a protein as one of those long strings, right, your body can't use it. There's nothing it can do with that. So the part of your digestion, it goes and it breaks that apart into little strings. But the only things your body can really use with that are when you break them down into the single units, and those are called amino acids. In the process of breaking it down to those little units, and if you've ever had a long string of them, you probably have done this, you take it, you pop it in half, and then you pop each of those halves again, and then you keep popping them until you have the individual units. That's the way the body digests protein.
Mm-hmm.
And each of those smaller units are called peptides. And some of the peptides that are formed when the gluten is broken down are actually look like opiates. And opiates, if you know what opiates are, the class of drug like morphine and cocaine and opium. Mm-hmm. And we actually have receptors in our brain for opiates. The reason is we produce endorphins, which are kind of those feel-good hormones, as a protection, as a, you know, part of our natural life. And we have receptors that will bind the opiates the same way they would bind our endorphins. So when you have this gluten and it gets broken down into these little particles and you have impaired digestion, which I would say 99.9% of the population of the world does because of the kind of diets we've been eating, that some of those shorter, those not fully broken down processes, those peptides that are opiates, get absorbed into your bloodstream. And then they circulate around, and they find the receptors in the brain, and they land there. And if you equate it, if you know anything about cocaine addiction or opiate addiction, you have a little bit, and then the body goes, oh, that was good, give me more. It sets up a whole addictive process. And part of it is because whereas a small amount might have given you a really good feeling, now the more you do it, the larger the amounts are that you need to get that good feeling. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
So that's what's happening in our bodies. And it's called, they've identified these chemical, these smaller proteins called, they call them gluteomorphines. morphine with the gluten attached to it, right? They've also identified somewhere between 10 and 20, I can't remember the exact number, but there's somewhere between 10 and 20 of those that exist in wheat, because wheat has the most potent ones. There's some of those in wheat that have been identified that are actually 20 times more potent than morphine. Okay, this isn't something...
Oh.
Yep, absolutely. This isn't some information I just found in some, you know, little raw foods magazine, or this was in the medical, you know, Journal of the American Medical Association type resources. And I have a whole paper that I wrote, a 20-page, 30-page paper that I wrote that was published on the effects of gluten and how it affects kids with neurodevelopmental disorders like autism, ADHD, Asperger's, and other sorts of developmental delays.
But this is the thing, like, if this information is being published in American medical journals, then why are people still pushing Wheaties?
That's a great question, and I was very frustrated as I did my research, because I would read these articles and I'd read the physiologic mechanisms. I would read about how it affects babies' brains as they're growing, and how it stops some of the neural connections from having, it blunts some of the neural connections, which is how it results in autism. Yet I'd find another paper that would say, oh, it's just a bunch of hullabaloo that people are putting people on very restricted diets to solve these problems when there's really no clear-cut evidence. Mm-hmm. And the issue is the same as everything else when you compare standard, you know, medicine to alternative practices, is there's no double-blind, placebo-controlled study that's been done that took, you know, some people with this problem and other people with this problem and put them on, you know, a gluten-free raw foods diet versus, you know, the standard American diet. Nobody did those studies because it would be considered cruel if you know that these people are going to get well and you don't give it to the other people. But it's also people won't follow. You can't get people that are willing to, like, you know, and get involved in these studies. And nobody will fund them. Who's going to fund it? The Wheaties people, right? Yeah. The Wonder Bread people? There's no money in proving that gluten causes problems for people. It's actually it's quite an economic problem causing, you know, to have people stop eating wheat.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it's kind of a... I don't want to go off onto conspiracy theories or being really negative, but it's... I mean... Yes, I totally agree and I understand. There are some people who have a vested interest in the promotion of those foods, so that may be one of the problems.
Right. And you know, if people say, well, it grows in nature, why is it a problem? That, you know, well, so does tobacco, right? So, but the real problem is we've so genetically modified it and hybridized it over the years because people discovered early on that the gluten is what makes the bread so attractive. Right, it makes the bread rise. It makes the bread, you know, nice and have that nice consistency that we love. So it's really hard pressed for people to go, wow, this gluten makes it good. Let's make the plant create more gluten so you have a better rising flour.
But I have to be honest too, and I grew up on a farm, so I'm a farm girl from Alberta. And I used to walk around in wheat fields, and I can tell you that if you're hungry in the afternoon and you're standing in the middle of a wheat field, it's not necessarily the most efficient fuel source you'll come across. The layers of hull or husk that you have to peel off, and then to get to this little nub of a grain inside, it's not even just looking at the human body. I mean, it's so much easier to grab a mango or a fruit or something like that, and it would be a far more efficient fuel source than to imagine myself feasting in a wheel of feet.
Right,
and
right.
And a field of wheat. It just doesn't necessarily make sense
that way because there's enzyme inhibitors in there, and until you actually sprout it, mm-hmm. or grind it down and cook it and do all this other stuff to it, it's really not very edible. So it's not in its natural form. It's not, you know, it's not good for, and I'm not saying it's bad and it's evil and nobody should ever do it, but a large percentage of the population actually has these antibodies that are formed with it. I mean, very large percentage of the population. It's estimated about 30%. I read a really good article by an MD who is a gastroenterologist who had been, you know, dealing with all these issues with patients and himself. And he, you know, he found that, you know, if he did the standard celiac testing, only a few of them showed up, but he was suspicious. He said that they're showing like things that remind me of celiac disease. And so he did some research. He discovered that there's a lab that actually does a test. And, you know, it's not the most pleasant test in the world because it's done with, it's a poop test. And, you know, they test for antibodies in there, and it's found to be much more accurate than the blood tests that they typically do. Because when you do the blood test, you actually, in order for it to show up positive, you actually have to have about 80% of your small intestine destroyed in order for it to show up. So, you know, I don't know about you, but I don't want to wait to find out I have a problem when it's 80% of my intestine is destroyed. I want to find it out early on. So he discovered this test, and he started testing people in his practice, and he got off of the gluten. He got all these people off of the gluten. For the people that didn't want to spend the money to get the test, he just said, okay, we'll experiment. We're going to get you off of gluten, and we're going to do it for 6 months. And he said the results in his practice were miraculous. Miraculous. And for him, he found that it was not just the GI stuff, but his depression, you know, other kinds of symptoms that he was having cleared up. And so that's what he promotes. And so his estimate was about 30% of the people showed up positive. And he's thinking that even, and I'm believing too, if you've got any problems that might be related to it, get off of it. You know, if you're running around and you're perfectly healthy, everything is fine, you're full of energy, you're clear-headed, you don't have any digestive problems, skin problems, thyroid problems, anything at all, you're perfectly healthy, and you eat some sprouted wheat sometimes, it's not going to cause you a problem, likely. But if you've got any kind of symptoms like depression, difficulty focusing, any kind of skin disorders, bowel disorders, any kind of brain dysfunction, thyroid conditions, hormonal imbalances, autoimmune disease of any sort, give the gluten-free a try. Absolutely, give it a try.
Okay. Why don't we, because I know, I mean, I had my daughter tested, actually, for gluteomorphines and caseomorphines. So, and I know people can do specific testing, but it's not necessary for us to spend $400-$500 on a test in order to recognize, hey, we're sensitive to something.
Exactly.
So maybe what you could do is address some of the symptoms that people might be experiencing so that they would be able to sort of recognize and identify. I mean, you've told us depression and things like this, but maybe just go over the symptoms again, like what someone who is sensitive or who might be struggling with something, then.
Oh, absolutely. Well, the first issue is, the first thing is the digestive stuff. So if you have any gas, bloating, irritable bowel, diarrhea, any kind of bowel symptoms can be related to gluten. And if anybody shows up in my office and they've got bowel stuff, I talk to them about gluten. And they don't want to hear it necessarily, but at least I put it out there. Secondly, if you've got any situations related to thyroid, and hypothyroid has become an epidemic. I mean, I would say that 30 to 50% of the people I see have been diagnosed with thyroid condition or suspect it based on the symptoms. That's huge, and we can go into another whole issue about why that is, but part of it is this gluten reaction. What they found is people with autoimmune thyroid condition, which is antibodies that are attacking their thyroid, they did this study, and it was published in one of the medical journals. Sorry, I'm not the type of, I don't have the type of brain that recalls every study and the dates, but I do have it in my paper. If anybody's interested in getting that, I can certainly send them a copy. But with the thyroid, the problem is you might get, like, difficulty losing weight. I hear that a lot from people that, you know, they've been moving towards a raw diet, they're on a mostly raw diet, but, you know, they still are not losing weight. And it's like, with looking at what they're eating, they should be losing weight. Well, if the thyroid is underfunctioning, they're going to have difficulty losing weight. You may have dry skin, brittle nails, hair that's either falling out or losing its luster. You may have a sluggish metabolism, meaning you're tired all the time. Your heart rate is really low. You have difficulty getting started in the morning. These kinds of things can be related to gluten. Brain fog is one I hear all the time. And I experienced it myself when I was playing around with this and going, oh, I'm not really allergic to this. I'm just going to try some whole wheat pasta and see. This is many years ago. And after being off of it for several weeks, I went and had this bowl of whole wheat pasta. And within, I would say, 30 minutes, I just wanted to take a nap. And Terry, you talk. I am not a tired person.
I was completely
wiped out. And I'm like,
oh, I know.
So if you're tired, or if you get tired after your meals, there's a chance that you're eating something that you're sensitive to.
Yeah. Good stuff.
And it's scary to think that you have a gluten problem, especially if you love your bread and your pasta. But that's, I see story after story of people who are on the process. A woman I've been coaching, and she called me last weekend, and she said, I just can't get out of bed. My kids are off playing tennis with their dad, and I can't join them. And I'm just, I said, so what happened? She goes, I went off my diet. What did you do? Well, I was out, and I had, you know, something, you know, a muffin or whatever. Ah, and I know every time I do that, this is what happens to me. It's sweet. Every time she eats wheat, she feels it. I had another person who, she went to a restaurant, and she was trying to be raw, completely raw. And she asked them, oh, you have a cucumber salad. It was an Asian restaurant. I'd love to have your cucumber salad. She went home, and within several hours, her ankles were swollen to twice their size. And she goes, what happened? I had a cucumber salad. We called the restaurant. They used soy sauce in the salad. The soy sauce.
Mari with wheat?
Yep. Okay.
Wow.
So it's hidden stuff like that. So if you're, if you are really good about staying on a raw diet and you eat things with nama shoyu in them, nama shoyu has wheat in it. And I am on a campaign to get that out. I've talked to lots of people with raw restaurants and raw chefs and people that are writing books to get rid of the nama shoyu. And at Raw Spirit Fest, one of the speakers, Jameth Sheridan, talked a lot about that. I was so happy to hear him talking about it because I was planning on talking about it too, is that you got to get off the nama shoyu. So, and it's hidden. It's hidden. You know, I've done the thing where I've gone to a raw restaurant and gone, oh, I want to order this and or that. Oh, I better ask if they use nama shoyu. And been restricted to just eating, drinking smoothies and eating dessert in a raw restaurant. Now, talk about the ultimate frustration. You finally out, and you think you can have a fancy meal, and it's got nama shoyu in it. It's it can be frustrating.
Yeah, totally. Speaking of frustrating, I think, I mean, one thing that's frustrating for a lot of people is the idea of how to eliminate these foods in the first place.
Yeah.
And when we've become, and I mean, first of all, I have no problem with it. I think the most important thing is for people to be able to take it on a gradient so that they don't get overwhelmed if they've been eating a lot. But what I thought we might want to do is, okay, if someone realizes, listen, I'm suffering with some health issues, my energy is low, I'm mucousy, I suffer from, you know, allergies, sensitivities, digestion's not going well, whatever. Now they decided that they want to take the plunge and start eliminating gluten from their diet. Where do you suggest they start?
You know, I love the idea of the gradient. What I've been doing with people is going, can we start with breakfast? Let's just get breakfast wired and don't worry about it for the rest of the day and really get it under control. So starting to do green smoothies in the morning, you know, doing, you know, the chopped up fruit with some sunflower seeds, just tons of really good breakfast recipes. I have a whole book on breakfast recipes that I wrote that are all great ways to start. So start with like no gluten before noon. That might be a way to start. Learning how to dehydrate is a great way because if it's breads and crackers and all those sorts of things, you can get a food dehydrator, and there's wonderful recipes that seem like they have, you know, your typical flour type stuff in it. They're crunchy, they're delicious, but they're made with nuts and seeds and vegetables. So what better way to substitute something that's toxic for you for something that's full of life and nutrition? So getting a dehydrator is a great place to start. If you can't start there, then there's all kinds of ways you can buy those crackers and things to have on hand when those temptations arise. So starting with breakfast and getting yourself a supply of some sort of dehydrated crackers to use in place of. You know, you can crumple them up and use them as croutons on a salad if that's what you're used to. There's wonderful ways that you can substitute pasta. I've written a couple of blog entries recently over the last few days that were kelp noodle recipes. And have you ever tried the kelp noodles?
Oh, gosh. I have an intimate love affair. Yeah,
I have you too. They're like my new found favorite food.
Yeah,
and they've got like 25 calories in the whole bag, 60% of your calcium for the day. And when you put a nice sauce over it and let it sit for about 10 or 15 minutes, they just, you know, collapse, and they're like these little bean thread clear noodles. They're wonderful. Mm. So those sorts of things, having those kinds of things that you can substitute, I think it's really important that you have substitutes. It's because it's a transition. You're not going to go, well, I'm going from this diet that I'm on with all this bread, and I'm just going to go eat like the monkeys. right? There's a gradient. There's ways to get from that way to eating like the monkeys if that's where you want to end up, right? So that, and then the spiralizer. You've used a spiralizer, I'm sure.
Yes.
So for people who don't know what that is, it's a little gadget. You can get them for like $20, $25 on the internet. And you take a piece of zucchini or any kind of cylindrical shaped vegetable, and you put it in this little thing. You twist and twist and twist, and out comes angel hair pasta. And then you can make any of the sauces that you typically would make, or you could make raw variations of it. But as a transition, buy a jar of ragu and throw it on it. That's better than eating the pasta that you've been doing, right? The people on this call may be a little bit further along that they're not going to be doing the ragu, but if you are, no big deal. That's the whole process of doing it in gradients. Let's hit get the big bullets out of there first, and then we'll go and attack the other stuff later. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I agree. Let's address some of the people, like, so maybe some people aren't necessarily interested in, I mean, I wouldn't mind talking about non-glutenous grains and if there are any contraindications, if there are any reasons why we shouldn't be eating those, but maybe you could just address which grains, you did at the beginning of it, but which grains people could use, even if they're not necessarily going into raw.
Yeah.
But if they just want to try and eliminate
gluten, Yeah, there's a whole lot of resources out there. I would caution you that right now there's a lot of products out there that are non-gluten that are also not healthy. There are some that are, but a lot of them will take out the gluten. They still will have eggs and dairy, and they'll use white rice flour in them and sugar. Like, that's not a healthy substitute. That's crazy. You have to go do a healthy non-gluten diet. So a healthy non-gluten diet would be, the best grains would be quinoa, Q-U-I-N-O-A. It's not said the way it's spelled. Everybody says it a little bit different. Some people might say it quinoa, but I think the way that it's derived is quinoa. And that's one of the best non-gluten grains. It's very high in protein and minerals, and it's easy to digest, and it's quick to cook. In addition to being able to cook it in about 20 minutes, you can also sprout it, and you can make tabbouleh with sprouted quinoa instead of wheat. And tabbouleh is a wonderful Middle Eastern dish with lots of mint and parsley. It's delicious. Well, it tastes just as good with sprouted quinoa or cooked quinoa if you don't want to go with the sprouting of the quinoa.
But sprouting is so easy.
What's that?
Sprouting is so easy.
Sprouting is easy. The issue is it takes a little longer. So if you're sitting down to a meal and you want something on the table quick, you might cook it, you know, for 20 minutes, and then you have it. Where with the sprouting, you have to think in advance. So not to say there's anything wrong with sprouting. It's far better to do the sprouting because it releases all the nutrients without damaging any of it. But if you are in a hurry and, you know, you don't mind cooking, that's a great way to go. It's very quick and easy. So quinoa and millet are my favorites. Brown rice is third in that list. Actually, there's a very unusual, some people may find it in their health food stores, but it's called TEFF, T-E-F-F. And if you can find that, that's actually preferable to brown rice because of the high mineral content. And it's an African. They use it a lot in Ethiopia. And in Ethiopia, they make a flatbread called injera from TEFF, which done the traditional way is a very nutritious bread substitute. So that's it. Those are the ones I would recommend. With the brown rice, I find that some people find it their intestines get very sluggish after they eat it. And if that's your situation, then, you know, watch that. Be conscious in your eating so that you don't end up eating things that you think are good substitutes, but they're creating problems in other ways. So those are the grains. There are non-gluten pastas. So there's one that is a rice pasta. It's called Tinkiata. I don't know if I'm allowed to say names of brands, but that's one that my kids, who don't do all raw, but they do all whole foods, non-gluten, vegan, they eat that. There's also one that's made with quinoa and corn. So if you're not sensitive to corn, that would be an alternative for a pasta that you would cook in the standard way. There's the bean thread noodles that you could get at the Asian markets that are non-gluten. Those are iffy because I think they take out, I think it's really refined because I think they take out some of the nutrients in there. But those are definitely non-gluten options. I was going with the gluten. One of the things I wanted to say was a reason not to do grains. You know, that's a good thing to know, because some people are what's called insulin resistant. People who are insulin resistant have a hard time with digesting starches without gaining weight. So if you have a body structure that's such that you tend to gain right around the middle and your waist tends to get larger or as large as your hips, and that's where you put on your weight, the chances are good that you are insulin resistant, and there's other symptoms that have to do with, you know, blood sugar irregularities, craving sweets after you finish a meal, not being able to go long periods of time without eating. You may have some insulin resistance, difficulty losing weight. If you have insulin resistance, it's a good idea to just, you know, trash the grains altogether. And I've seen people dramatically lose weight when they go off of that. And if you find people that go on a raw diet and, like, immediately drop tons of weight, those are those insulin-resistant people who all they had to do is get the grains off, and they probably would have dropped the same amount of weight. So.
Wow. Very helpful. I want to kind of switch into a different element of this. I think the advice has been really good and with giving people a gradient. One of the things that I'd like to discuss specifically, you kind of mentioned it, but maybe we can address it more specifically, is the link to autism, ADD, and ADHD, because I think this is something that, you know, I don't know the percentages anymore, but of children who are being put on Ritalin because they're distracted or these kinds of situations. Maybe you can address how this is affecting.
I can. Would you mind if I share a quick little story just to
put No, of course.
I had a little boy. A mom came to see me about her little boy, and he was having all kinds of problems at school, and the school was suggesting they put him on Ritalin. She didn't want to. She came to see me. We talked about some stuff. We talked about all the possibilities that it could be, and I said, you know, you could either do all of this or we could start with one thing. And she started with one thing, two things, actually, which was doing some probiotics because he'd just been on antibiotics. And probiotics are actually like Lactobacillus acidophilus and those sorts of things that replace your normal gut flora. She did that for like a week or two to replace that, but she also got him off of the gluten. And he went back to school. This was after just a week or two of being off the gluten, and the teachers were going, you know, we're really glad that you changed your mind and put him on Ritalin.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then they had an accidental exposure, and he was crazy again. He went off the walls, and it was like, oh, my God, this is what's doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, I really, and this is kind of what I wanted, you know, I've been waiting for us to get to the, like, you know, you called yourself a gluten Nazi, and we chose to adjust the terminology just a little bit.
I like that better.
Oh, you're a glutenator. But I really think, you know, and I've seen my daughter go into full-blown psychosis after exposure to gluten. And I think maybe, you know, and we actually had her tested, so, I have to go into the results. But I've seen how dramatically food can affect children. And when children are already being confronted with all the other stresses that they have, you know, this is just one food element. There are so many alternatives to gluten, and I know people are hooked on it. I know it's addictive. It's not easy to get off. But start with rice crackers. Start with rice cakes, rice, quinoa noodles, I don't care what. Right. When you realize how dramatically it is affecting lives of children, I really, like, this is what I wanted, is when the earth-shattering, you have to understand this stuff can actually create psychotic breaks in children.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, there's a whole mechanism that's described that causes that. It has to do with specific areas of the brain and specific antibodies. And I don't, you know, want to go into all that. I do that in my paper. But there's actually physiologic mechanism for it. And I'm not saying that it's the be-all and the end-all for every kid that has a behavioral problem or is autistic, that's all you have to do is get them off gluten. It's beyond that. You have to restore the damage. You have to look at their detoxification. There's so many aspects of it. But for some, it's the missing puzzle piece that you see, like, the dramatic effects immediately. There's a in Austin that had a son that was autistic, and she started doing research, decided to take him off of the gluten, and it reversed the autism. And she was just so thrilled she decided to start, and it was actually casein too. She took them off the dairy too. She decided to start a little food service where she would make gluten-free meals for people, and she appeals to the autistic community, the parents of the autistic kids. It has a dramatic effect. When we look at autism, we look at that as, there's something called the autistic spectrum. And autism is the end point, if you want to call it that, where it's the most severe symptoms. But really, all of these other conditions are on the spectrum, from, ADHD, distractibility, inability to focus, Asperger's disease, all the way up to full-blown autism. They're all similar in their mechanisms of action. It's just how it affects each individual child based on other factors, their exposures, their genetics.
Mm-hmm. And, even if we took all of these things aside, even if we put all the medical journals and all the reports and all the stories aside, I think any person could be, and I don't want to say should, but could challenge themselves to eliminate these foods for a given amount of time and then see for themselves how it feels to reintegrate. And I don't know if that's the elimination provocation, if this is where you take something out and then you reintroduce it. But if someone wanted to do that, to find out for themselves, how would you suggest they go about it?
Okay.
How much time would they need to eliminate it and those kinds of things?
A great question. And I wish I had a cookie-cutter answer for that question as far as the amount of time, but it does vary. So here's the deal. If you're going to do that, what you need to do is educate yourself on all the hidden sources of gluten, because this is the problem. If you're eating in restaurants, if you're eating packaged foods, there's all sorts of names of things that are hidden sources of gluten, and you may not even know about it. I did some research. I found some lists. I have a list on my website on the page, the gluten resources page or gluten-free resources page on my website that has a list of that. And it's just something I found on the internet and I've been, kind of playing around with. But it's all over the place. So you really have to educate yourself about the hidden sources, like the soy sauce and the tamari and all that kind of stuff. And you have to be really clean about it for a length of time. Now, here's the deal. Some people will see, after a couple of weeks, they'll see dramatic changes. It depends on how much damage has been done by the gluten. For example, like for thyroid stuff, they found that for some people it took 6 months for the thyroid to actually be restored to its normal function. And if that's the case where you have some sort of an autoimmune condition going on, where your joints are being attacked or your pancreas is being attacked or your thyroid, it's a longer period of time before you see the full-blown results. But most people will see improvements pretty quickly. If you start to see improvements and you it's been 3-4 weeks and you introduce the food back, you're going to see a full-blown reaction if that's what it was. So it could be as short as several weeks, but for some people it may take longer to see the full-blown improvement depending on how serious and deep the problem is.
And while we've been discussing, the severity of some of the reactions that some people can have, mm-hmm. I'm not anyone who's been hypersensitive to foods. I don't know that I necessarily have a sensitivity, although I kind of question whether all humans don't have some degree of sensitivity to gluten. But what I can say is, and for me, I noticed a difference within 3 days. There's no problem. I can really feel mm-hmm. that, the first 3 days that I got off of grains, I felt a big difference. And, but reintroducing them now that gluten has been largely out of my life for a very long time, if it somehow manages to sneak back in, I'm very aware of it. Mm-hmm. I really see the difference. And while I don't have any extreme symptoms, I just do not feel myself. I lose my ability to control my eating. So I think another thing for people who, and I know we have a lot of people, whether they're in the closet about it or not, who suffer from eating disorders and binge eating and things like this. And I know that wheat and gluten specifically is a huge culprit in sort of triggering these kinds of reactions in relation to food.
Absolutely. So, 4 days is the minimum that you should be away from it because that's the half-life of the antibodies. Mm-hmm. So in 4 days, if you're off of a food that you're allergic to in general, you reintroduce it after 4 days. and you see if you have a reaction to it. The problem with gluten, with doing it that way, is that if indeed your problem is more of a subtle problem, like you don't get the way you do, you get that reaction, but the problem is that it affects the thyroid or it's affecting some other organ via an autoimmune disease, you may not be able to see the change quite that quickly.
Right.
But 4 days at the minimum, 6 months at the absolute, you know, where if you have a problem with it and you're off of it for 6 months, and you don't see a change, if you stay away from it for 6 months and don't see a change, and when you reintroduce it, you don't see any changes, then you probably don't have a problem with it.
Okay.
But it's hard to rule out. It's easy to rule in, but hard to rule out in shorter periods of time. Does that make sense?
Do you need
Yeah. That? Yeah. Yeah. So there was a study that was done that showed that people who were sensitive to gluten, if they had a mild exposure, like a once a month a crouton accidentally fell into their salad and they ate it, that it would start the whole inflammatory process all over again and delay their response.
Yeah, I heard it. I've heard it referred to as little as a fingernail's worth. Yeah, really. Tiniest amount for a person who is seriously sensitive, the tiniest amount.
But the issue you brought up, though, is that it's not just people who are having an immune system reaction that really need to watch it. It's people who may not be, but they're reacting to the morphines in there. And that the clear example of that you gave was the people with food addictions.
Yeah.
And I have a friend who was depressed, and I said, get off the gluten, see how it goes. I've tried it. And I go for about 2 weeks without the bread, and then all of a sudden I'm just like craving it, and I can't stop myself. So we started to dig, and I said, do you ever go for Chinese food? She said, yeah, I go for Chinese food. I said, how often do you go for Chinese food? Oh, about every 2 weeks.
Yeah,
stick with that one and see if bread cravings come within 24 hours after being at the Chinese restaurant. Okay?
Yeah.
And sure enough, right, that was what it was.
Yeah.
So it can be real subtle. You know, not everybody wants to go 100% gluten-free, but if you've got any health issues at all, I highly encourage you to do it. Like I said at the beginning, if you're this, like, super energetic, running around, you've got plenty of energy, you never sick a day in your life, you never have any sluggishness except for when you're tired from lack of sleep, your brain is clear, you're focused, your GI tract works perfectly, your skin is great, then, you know, chances are, just don't overdo it, because it can cause problems even in the people that aren't sensitive to it. But you don't have to be that so super rigid, you know, that you're obsessed about keeping the gluten out.
Good. One of the things I better do before I get too distracted with my own questions is just check in and see about the questions that might be coming in from other people, if that's okay with you.
Yeah.
Let's pull these up. Ah, yeah, that's really funny. The next question, oh my gosh, there are lots.
Okay.
The next question is one that I was thinking of going to, which is about wheatgrass. So I know a lot of people like to juice wheatgrass, and we hear about that. Let's address the issue of wheatgrass and also sprouted wheat.
Yes, those are great questions. I love those questions. Okay, so here's what we know. We know that there's gluten in the grain when you start out. We know that the grass itself doesn't have gluten. It's completely broken down, and it's now a green plant, and it has all the properties of a green plant. Somewhere along the way, the gluten is being broken down in the process, through the sprouting process, and it's broken down and broken down and broken down, but nobody's ever done a study to say at what point does the sprout actually no longer contain gluten. Is it a 3-day sprout? Is it a 7-day sprout? How long does it take for all of the gluten to be converted into its amino acids? We don't know, right? So wheatgrass is totally safe, completely safe. But here's the deal. You want to make sure that you cut it an inch above where the seed is, because you don't know if there's still gluten in the seed. So, you know, that's the typical way that it's recommended. You go to the Hippocrates Institute or any of the retreat centers that use wheatgrass as a therapeutic, they always teach you to cut it an inch above the seed. If you go to a juice bar, they're probably doing that, but you don't know if they're being careless and throwing a piece in there. So I'm not saying to stay away from wheatgrass, but I'm saying that if you have wheatgrass and you have a reaction that's as if you've eaten gluten, chances are good that it's because some of the actual gluten grain has gotten into it. I caution people about the powders because you don't know what the process was. I actually went to a health fair and there's all the booths out there, and the guy was saying, hey, we have this great product, and it's all, you know, the wheatgrass, and we actually grind up the whole thing, including the seed. I'm like, and you're touting that as a benefit? I'm not sure why. First of all, it's less labor intensive for them to do that. So it's really an economic thing. But on the other hand, you get the gluten in there because you've got the seed. You might get the gluten. We don't know, right, if there's still gluten left in the seed. And I wouldn't take a chance if I had really severe gluten stuff. So wheatgrass, great. Sprouts, I'm not sure. Now, here's my other thing, and this is totally my theory. I've never read it anywhere, but it's just my brain, you know, making circles around this, is that if you sprout it, remember I talked about the long chain of the amino acid, like that big long chain of plastic bubble things? It's the dipeptides and the tripeptides, the shorter chains that cause the morphine-type reaction that are actually there. So I don't know, again, at what point that breakdown is complete. So I don't know if possibly the sprouted may have some more of the morphine effect than the full-blown wheat itself before it sprouted. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
And I don't know. I've never read it anywhere. It's just that was what my brain, I went, oh, as soon as I read about the short peptides that were morphine-like, I went, ooh, what about the sprouts? Because that's what sprouting does, right? You take the big long chain of amino acids and it starts to break it down, and it's shorter and shorter and shorter until it's completely down into its full amino acids. But we don't know.
Mm-hmm. You kind of mentioned, so thank you for answering that one. You kind of mentioned oats and said that oats are questionable about gluten. Can you address that?
Yeah, and I have just not been able to put that one to bed. The thing about the gluten molecule and the different types of grains that contain it, you know, wheat and barley, spelt and all, it's they're all slightly different. And they have these fancy little chemical names for them, and they label them and all that. Well, there is one that they label gluten-like in oats, but it's not like the full-blown gliadin that's in wheat and some of the others. But there is something that is gluten-like. They've done studies where they've taken full-blown celiac people and given them oats, and they have not had a problem, or a large percentage of them have not had a problem, but some of them do. So the issue is, I think that's one you have to find out for yourself. When I have somebody who has symptoms of gluten intolerant, I usually recommend that they go off of oats for a while, too, and then that would be the thing that they would test first.
Okay. Good.
And I don't think that they have. I don't think the opiates are in the oat. In fact, I'm pretty sure the opiates are not in the oats. So it's completely the immunological.
Thank you. This is one I hadn't thought of before. What about potatoes? Do they contain gluten?
Potatoes do not contain gluten. No.
Perfect. Okay. We sort of talked about what's, you know, how to approach a transition, and there's someone who wants to know, should a transition be swift or should it be measured? For example, go completely gluten-free immediately, or what would be the best course of action to eliminate the stuff for your diet?
The ideal for your health benefits would be just, you know, rapid fire, terminate it, done,
mm-hmm.
quick. For your psychology and your emotional system, it may be better to go slowly. If you're the type of person that if you go cold turkey on it, and after a couple of weeks you're just going to, like, forget this whole thing, I'm going out and eating a chocolate cake, then you need to go slowly. You need to, like, find all your substitutes. Start with the rice crackers. You know, go into the dehydrated crackers. You know, replace the pastas. Just have a plan in place to eliminate it. If you try to go cold turkey, it may be a problem. But if you're the type of person that goes, ew, this isn't good for me, I'm done, then cold turkey is the best way to go.
Okay, good. We've addressed briefly depression, and I know there are some people who struggle in no small way with depression.
Oh, yeah, it's serious.
Yeah. Can you elaborate a little bit on the link between depression and gluten?
Yeah, it has to do with the inflammatory process that it has in the brain and the way that it interferes with neurotransmitters. and I can give you a case of this one woman I work with came in to see me. She was so distraught because she'd been on antidepressants for like 15 years. They weren't working anymore. They were talking about either upping her dose, which she didn't want to do, or switching her out altogether, which she knew was going to be problematic and hard to transition. She says, is there anything I can do? Well, I said, sure, and let's work on it. And we got her on a gluten-free, casein-free diet, high raw, lots of vegetables and greens. Within a month, not only was she feeling great, you know, she wasn't feeling that she needed a higher dose, but she started to drop her dose. So it just affects the neurotransmitters. It affects the ability of the body to communicate properly between the neurons and keep the balance and the emotional stability. It's not the be-all and the end-all. It's not the only thing. And I want to be real clear. Just going on a gluten-free diet is not the be-all and the end-all, right? But if you do a raw diet or a vegan diet and you don't go gluten-free, you're not going to see the results that you would if you go gluten-free. If you go gluten-free and you just do a lot of the cardboard foods, you're not going to get the complete results you would if you incorporated high green, high raw, you know, really low toxicity diet.
You know, and that's so true because I've heard so many people who have told stories of, oh, I tried going on the vegetarian diet, but I just felt terrible. And then you realize how much gluten or even dairy products mm-hmm. are in the average vegetarian diet, and you realize to what degree it would cause a person to not feel well just going vegetarian, you know?
Absolutely. And at the risk of you know, people being offended, I'm going to say this. I would rather see somebody be on an 80 or 90% raw vegan, high gluten-free, dairy-free diet, or you know, even cooked vegan, with 10% some kind of animal products like fish or organically raised meat, wild game, whatever. I would rather see that than somebody who's on a vegetarian diet and still doing dairy and wheat. I think it's a much healthier way to go.
Well, and I think it's just common sense. Like, in nature, you could probably catch a fish. But what are the chances that you're going to chase down a cow, get its mammary secretions, and then leave it fermenting for a few days in some kind of salty brine? You know, it makes more sense from an anatomical and natural,
right,
just logical perspective.
Absolutely.
So I understand.
Absolutely. So, yeah.
I'm just going to wiggle over here and see. I know there are a few more questions. So you did address the sprouted grains, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a substitute that you recommend for soy sauce? Like, I know some people use Bragg's. I think in some countries it's called liquid aminos, and some it's called a soy something. How do you feel about that one?
Okay, well, Bragg's, because of the way their process is done, it tends to create more of the excitatory response, like the MSG type response. It actually will create MSG. So
that stuff is totally addictive for me.
Totally addictive, right.
I have had to flush it just down the sink to stop myself from consuming it at odd hours.
No, my son would take a bottle of it. I bought it for a while, and he'd take it, and he'd actually squirt it into his mouth and just drink it.
Yep.
We're not buying that anymore. Okay, so what do you do with that? What I would recommend and what I would do, I don't generally use it. I've just kind of learned how to use things to get away from it. For what you really want it for is to give you an Asian flair to the dishes. That's what I look at it as. Oh, it tastes like it's a, you know, an Asian dish. That's what I'm looking for. Most of your raw recipe books that use a lot of the nama shoyu, quite frankly, they use it just indiscriminately. It's like every other recipe has it. And personally, and this is not a knock on anybody, but it's like if I'm making a recipe and I'm trying to balance the taste and I get to a point where, like, it's not quite right, if I just squirt some nama shoyu in it, it's going to taste good and I can be done rather than try to go further with the flavor balancing. So I think a lot of times it's just used because it's a flavor enhancer and it makes the food really good. But it's not necessary. So if you're looking for an Asian thing, I would get a wheat-free, gluten-free tamari and use that. It's cooked, but it's pasteurized, but it's still a much better choice, and you're only going to use a little bit. And you'll find that it's not quite as addicting as some of the other substitutes.
I've also heard that sun-dried tomatoes, like if you take good sun-dried tomatoes and soaks them in water, that soak water can become quite concentrated after a while, and that can also make a good substitute.
Right. So if you're looking for a flavor enhancer, that's an awesome way to do it. Another thing is you can use miso, which is a fermented soy product as well, but it's a much more aged process, and it just tends to have a lot of the good probiotic organisms. So you could actually take a little bit of miso and add it to a recipe and get a similar flavor as you would soy sauce and or tamari, and it's much better for you because it's really got all those good organisms. And then, you know, as far as for flavors, there's just so many ways to do the flavoring. There's a whole flavor balancing techniques that you can use. I have a little booklet, and if anybody wants it, maybe we can set it up so that we can have them, you know, go and sign up and get it from my website. But it's just a balancing. It's like going through the flavors of salt and sweet and, you know, sour and all that, and figuring out how to make your food taste really super good without stimulants.
So I know you have another recipe that you gave me that we can pass along. One of the things I'll do is maybe post on the blog and email anyone who signed up for this call. I'll just follow up. So if you want to forward me the links that you'd like people, because you've told us about some articles and stuff, and I know you sent me a few of them,
mm-hmm.
but then why don't you, after this call, you can send me some things, and then we can email everyone who's listened to the teleseminar and make sure that they have access to more information on your website.
Great. Wonderful. Yes, we can do that for sure.
I'm going to sneak in a couple more questions before I let you escape. One of them is, this is interesting, I did read a study once, an article written about rats who had been put sort of through some tests and given gluten. A test group was given gluten and another one wasn't, and the ones that were given gluten would start biting each other and getting very aggressive, and the other ones didn't. And they found that the reactions were worse with whole wheat grains than white bread. And one of the questions that came in asking, like, if I'm going to eat gluten or wheat, which is better, white bread or whole wheat?
Okay. Well, here's the deal. There's two answers to that. Always whole, because the white is stripped of all the nutritional value and it's just pure starch. The reason that it's worse with a whole wheat versus a white is, say you take a whole food, you take this wheat, and it's got, in its whole form, let's just say for argument's sake it's 50% protein. It's not, but I'm just throwing that number out because it's easy to play with. It's 50% protein, right? Now, if you go ahead and you take away a lot of the other stuff that's in it, a lot of the bran and the germ and all that, which contains some of that, and you get down to what's left, the percentage of protein in the resulting is going to be lower than the percent in the first thing. I do the math on that. I did the math on that once, and now my brain is going, is that right? But I've done the math on that, and it has to do with because there's less of the protein. There's a less percentage of protein you'd think it would be the opposite. Let me stir on that one, because I don't want to be held to that answer, because that's what I was thinking, and I think that might not be true. Let me think about that one a little bit and get back to you, because I just had a little disconnect there in my head, and I don't want to seem right.
Have you been eating gluten? I'm joking.
Yeah.
Okay. So some people have specific questions about their own health conditions, maybe that they have thyroid, or they'd like to lose weight, or they'd like to gain weight.
Yeah.
I know you have some resources too, and you might be able to help people more individually. I know you and I have planned coming up as part of the Body Enlightenment System a special call on weight loss.
Yes.
And we also have coming up a 6-week detox program that we're going to be announcing a little bit more of that in a day or two. There's some details to sort out and finalize.
Right.
But what about people who might like to get in touch with you for more specific information? Why don't we use this chance to let people know the best way to reach you if they have more questions or would like to know more about the services that you offer?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, you can go to my website, which is you can enter it in two ways, as it's drritamarie.com or freshandfunliving.com, and I can spell both of those for you. The drritamarie.com is drritamarie.com. You can email me at drritamarie@drritamarie.com. Or you can go via Fresh and Fun Living. You might be able to remember that link better. It's just the word fresh, the letter N, the word fun, and then the word living.com. And you can see the different resources out there. I've got various options for doing coaching, whether it's just a single kind of a strategy session all the way up to, you know, full-blown coaching programs. And so you can do that. The strategy session is really good for just, like, you know, addressing a few things. You really feel like you got a handle on how to do this, but you just want some few questions answered. It's also a good place to jumpstart and get to know each other and see if working together is a good option.
Yes.
If you go to my website and you click on health coaching, There's a couple of links to it. Just dig around there, and you'll find the coaching links, and you can find out more about those programs.
Okay, that's awesome.
Yeah.
So, yes, I want to thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. What were you going to say?
I've also got some free different recipe books and things. One of the things that I offer people when I do teleseminars, it's just a little package of green resources. And in there, I've got a presentation that I did on thyroid, and it might be really helpful for people because you said there's some thyroid questions came up. And if you just go to drritamarie.com/ just the word green, G-R-E-E-N, no caps, just all lowercase, that'll lead you to a page where you could sign up for this three-part e-books and presentation and an audio that will answer a lot of your questions.
Nice. I have two little more that I've wiggled in here, and I'm going to ask them just because one has come up a few times. One of the questions is Rejuvelac. Is that okay for people to use?
Generally, it's fine, yeah.
Because they're not using the actual berries.
Yeah, it's actually, you just have to make sure you follow a recipe where it's, they don't grind the berries up, you just drain the liquid off.
Okay.
There are some recipes I've seen where you actually do the whole process, and then you grind up the berries with the liquid. And that might or might not be. That's the whole issue of we don't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then the last question that I'm going to slip in here, the rest, I guess, if people have more questions, they can contact you or contact us, is, I thought we got into it, but buckwheat. Did we not mention buckwheat?
Oh, no, we didn't. You mentioned
you
wanted to talk about buckwheat. Buckwheat is wonderful. Okay? It doesn't have gluten. However, you have to watch that you don't OD on buckwheat because there are some chemicals in there that are actually neurotoxins.
You see, this is so interesting. Just this week I've been making buckwheat granola, and I actually wrote on the blog, buckwheat is doing something to me, and I want to ask Dr. Rita Marie. So I had forgotten to ask my own question. Thank goodness Nancy in California remembered.
Mm-hmm.
But that's so interesting because I really could feel that I was having a hard time stopping, and I know that there's no gluten in it, but I was really feeling like, so explain to us what neurotoxins do.
Yeah, well, neurotoxins actually don't usually affect that, like the addiction kind of things, but what happens a lot of times because the buckwheat can be so similar to the wonderful foods we remembered as gluten, it's triggering more of an emotional addiction than a physical addiction. It's like, oh, yeah, it's bread. Oh, my God, it's like crackers. Oh, it's cereal. Oh, you know, and it creates this whole emotional addiction pattern. So that could be the neurotoxins actually cause, like, numbness and tingling and increased cold sensitivity in your limbs. And I found it out the hard way by having bought, you know, trays and trays of this wonderful buckwheat sprouts and started just making green drinks out of it. And I had this wonderful drink, which is like half of a tray of buckwheat sprouts. And I suddenly developed this like horrible neurotoxic reaction in my hands. And I thought, oh my God, something's wrong with me. Something's seriously wrong with me. And I started doing research and found out indeed it was the buckwheat. And as soon as I stopped, I was fine.
So you're talking about the buckwheat greens.
Buckwheat
is that the same thing as the grain?
Buckwheat greens. Right, but the same stuff is in there, whether it's the greens or the whole sprouted buckwheat. You just have to be careful not to overdo. But everything has toxins in it. That's the thing, right? Everything nature does. You can overdose on kale and cause your thyroid to shut down. You can overdose on carrots. You can overdose on lots of things because everything has some sort of protective toxin in it that protects the plant in nature. So the whole point is variety, variety, variety. And you know, rotation diets seem like that's too crazy because you have to calculate, did I do this 3 days ago? But the concept of the rotation diet, where you just eat a wide variety of things and you don't just get stuck in a rut of eating the same food over and over and over and over again. And then you reduce.
Yeah. So. Awesome. This has been so helpful, and I'm going to do whatever I can to come up with some great recipes to post on the blog and help encourage people. But I really want to thank you for your time and for sharing all your wisdom with us. And give us your website one more time.
It's freshandfunliving.com. Fresh, the word fresh, F-R-E-S-H, N, the letter N, living, L-I-V-I-N-G.com.
Oh, you missed the word fun. Fresh and fun.
Fresh and fun. Or drritamarie.com. And if you /with the word green, it will get you to the little thing where you can sign up and get the green packet with all the neat little recipes and the thyroid presentation.
Perfect. And I will definitely be notifying anyone who signed up to take this call about future calls that we'll be doing with you. And I'm very excited.
Wonderful.
And thank you. Yeah, thank you again so much for all your time.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thank you for inviting me. I really enjoyed it.
Me too. Have a great day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.